I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
A large number of injured have come to us after the large explosion that shook the entire Jabalia refugee camp. Hundreds of injuries, hundreds of martyrs. They were just sitting in their homes. They were targeted while they were in their homes.
Israel's bombed Gaza's largest refugee camp, Jabalia, again. A day after massive Israeli airstrikes killed at least 50 Palestinians and wounded over 150, sparking new outrage over Israel's 26-day bombardment of the besieged territory. We'll speak with a humanitarian advocate who grew up in Jabalia.
Actually, the bombing took place in the center of the heart of the refugee camp, where it's one of the most densely populated places in Gaza. While everyone knows is Gaza one of the most densely populated places on Earth.
Then we'll speak to a longtime human rights attorney, Craig McIver, a top United Nations official in New York who's resigned, saying the UN is failing to stop what he calls a genocide unfolding in Gaza. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Gaza, Israel struck the densely populated Jabalia refugee camp again today, one day after Israeli air attack killed at least 50 people and injured another 150. This is a doctor who treated victims of the Jabalia attack at the Indonesian hospital, where surgeons had to operate in the hallways as the facility was overrun with patients.
A large number of injured have come to us after the large explosion that shook the entire Jabalia refugee camp. Hundreds of injuries, hundreds of martyrs. They were just sitting in their homes. They were targeted while they were in their homes. Children, all martyrs, children, women, elderly. We have no idea what to do. They are injured everywhere. All the volunteers went down hand in hand just to help people.
The World Health Organization's warning of an imminent public health catastrophe in Gaza, with some surgeries performed without anesthesia due to the dire shortage of medical supplies. Mohammed Abu Al-Kamsan, an engineer with Al Jazeera's Gaza Bureau, lost 19 members of his family, including his father and two sisters, in Israeli air raids on the Jabalia camp. Meanwhile, the first evacuations from Gaza through the Rafah border crossing with Egypt have begun. Officials are expected to let people with foreign passports and dozens of critically injured residents leave Gaza. The temporary border opening is part of a deal brokered by Qatar. In Washington, D.C., protesters on Tuesday repeatedly disrupted a Senate panel hearing for Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. Their testimony was in support of President Biden's request for $106 billion to fund the militaries of Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan, and to militarize the U.S.-Mexico border. This is Ann Wright, former U.S. Army colonel and Code Pink member.
3,500 kids dead. Come on, I'm an Army colonel. I'm a former diplomat. I resigned on that war in Iraq that you talked about. That was a terrible thing, and what they're doing right now and supporting Israel's genocide of Gaza is a terrible thing, too. Stop the war! Ceasefire now!
This comes as House Republicans are proposing stripping $14 billion in IRS funding to fulfill Biden's request for $14 billion for Israeli military aid. Senate Finance Committee Chair Ron Wyden said in response, quote, House Republicans are using aid for Israel as a political pawn in order to slash taxes for their wealthy donors. Making it easier for rich people to cheat on their taxes isn't an offset. It adds to the deficit, he said. Newly elected House Speaker Mike Johnson has also said he wants to sever funding for Ukraine from funding for Israel, setting up a likely showdown with Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. On Tuesday, senators confirmed former Treasury Secretary Jack Lew as the U.S. ambassador to Israel. At his confirmation hearing, Lew said Israel's security is paramount. Meanwhile, the White House evoked the white supremacists who marched in Charlottesville in 2017 when answering questions about Palestinian rights protesters. This is White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre responding to Fox reporter Peter Ducey.
You guys don't talk about extremists all the time. It is usually about MAGA extremists. So what about these protesters who are making Jewish students feel unsafe on college campuses? Are they extremists?
I've been very, very clear. We are calling out any form of hate.
The head of the King Center, Dr. Bernice King, lawyer and daughter of Martin Luther King Jr., responded to a post by comedian Amy Schumer, who shared a video of Dr. King condemning anti-Semitism and defending Israel's right to exist. Bernice King wrote, quote, "Certainly my father was against anti-Semitism. He also believed militarism, along with racism and poverty, to be among the interconnected triple evils. I am certain he would call for Israel's bombing of Palestinians to cease," she said. Here in New York, the longtime human rights attorney Craig McIver, director of the New York Office of UN High Commissioner of Human Rights, and stepped down in protest over the UN's failure to stop the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza, which he called a textbook case of genocide. He blamed the United States, the UK, and much of Europe for its complicity. We'll be joined by Craig McIver later in the broadcast. Meanwhile, Chile and Colombia have recalled their ambassadors to Israel, while Bolivia has cut diplomatic ties with Israel, citing crimes against humanity.
Based on its principled stance of respect towards life, Bolivia has decided to break diplomatic relations with the Israeli state in repudiation and condemnation of the aggressive and disproportionate Israeli military offensive taking place in the Gaza Strip, which threatens international peace and security.
In Belgium, transportation unions have called on their over 3 million members to refuse to aid in the delivery of weapons to Israel, citing genocide against Palestinians. The unions called for a ceasefire and asked the Belgian government to not allow arms to travel through Belgian ports. Yemen's Houthi militia said it launched air attacks in southern Israel Tuesday in response to the, quote, brutal Israeli-American aggression in Gaza, unquote. Separately, Israel said it thwarted air attacks but did not disclose the source. This comes after Saudi Arabia said four of its soldiers died last week while fighting Houthi rebels on its border with Yemen. The U.S. announced this week it's sending an additional 300 troops to the Middle East to, quote, support regional deterrence efforts. In Iran, authorities have detained prominent human rights lawyer Nasreen Sotoudeh. She was arrested and severely beaten by police Sunday while she attended the funeral of 16-year-old Armita Garavand, who died of brain injuries last week after she was reportedly assaulted by Iran's morality police at a Tehran subway station in early October. Police also attacked and arrested other activists and mourners at the funeral as they demanded justice for Garavand. Sotoudeh has been arrested in prison several times before. Burma is formalizing efforts to repatriate Rohingya refugees who fled genocide and persecution since 2017. Burmese officials met with Rohingya refugee families in Bangladesh Tuesday to discuss the repatriation plan, which was negotiated by Burma, Bangladesh and China back in April. Burma said it's ready to accept the return of some 3,000 Rohingya refugees by December. But refugees have refused to go back, fearing further violence. Rohingya leaders said certain demands should be met, including resettlement to their own land and being granted citizenship. Rohingya community members have also said they've been threatened with accepting repatriation, while Burmese officials claim the move would be voluntary. About 1 million Rohingya refugees live in Bangladesh. Pakistani police have started arresting Afghans as part of a nationwide crackdown on immigrants. Over 4 million Afghans live in Pakistan. Islamabad says nearly 2 million of them are undocumented. Tens of thousands of Afghans were forced to return to Afghanistan in the last month since Pakistani authorities threatened them with mass deportation if they didn't leave by November 1st, today. Many Afghans who've called Pakistan home for decades fear having to live under Taliban rule and say they have nothing to go back to in Afghanistan.
We are helpless. We have nothing in our homeland. No home, nowhere to go. For the past 2 days, we've been waiting here, but no one is doing anything about our crossing over. What should we do? Now that we have come here, we should at least be allowed to cross over.
In Kenya, King Charles acknowledged Britain's, quote, deepest regret for its, quote, abhorrent and unjustifiable acts of violence committed against the former colony. But King Charles stopped short of an apology as he delivered his speech during a banquet as part of his four-day trip to Kenya. The Kenya Human Rights Commission had called on Charles to offer an unequivocal public apology. The group estimates the Mau Mau revolt in central Kenya between 1952 and 1960 killed or maimed some 90,000 Kenyans. Another 160,000 were detained. The UK agreed in 2013 to a £20 million settlement for the atrocities it committed. This is the great-grandson of King Kotelel Arap Samoei, a Nandi chief who fought to end British colonial rule at the turn of the last century.
In fact, we don't request. In fact, we have to demand a public apology from the government of British because of the atrocities they meted on our people. The first one is an apology. After the apologies, we also expect a reparation.
And the Michigan Attorney General's office is closing its criminal pursuit of public officials responsible for the Flint water crisis, including former Governor Rick Snyder. It's been nearly a decade since Michigan leaders switched Flint's drinking water source to the Flint River to save money. The water corroded Flint's aging pipes, causing poisonous levels of lead to leach into the drinking water, causing many residents in the majority black city, particularly children, to develop health problems. An outbreak of Legionnaire's disease killed at least 12 people. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, Israel's bombed Gaza's largest refugee camp, Jabalia, again, a day after its massive airstrikes killed at least 50 Palestinians and wounded over 150, sparking new outrage over Israel's 26-day bombardment of the besieged territory. We'll speak with a humanitarian advocate who grew up in Jabalia. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Massive Israeli airstrikes on Gaza's largest refugee camp, Jabalia, killed at least 50 Palestinians Tuesday and wounded over 150 others, sparking new outrage over Israel's 26-day bombardment of the besieged territory. Israel bombed the refugee camp again today. Numerous residential buildings collapsed in Tuesday's blast, trapping families under rubble. One engineer from Al Jazeera, Mohammed Abu Al-Khamsan, reportedly lost at least 18 members of his family, including his father and two of his sisters. A long line of dead bodies wrapped in white sheets were placed outside the Indonesian hospital in the refugee camp where doctors scrambled to treat survivors.
A large number of injured have come to us after the large explosion that shook the entire Jabalia refugee camp. Hundreds of injuries, hundreds of martyrs. They were just sitting in their homes. They were targeted while they were in their homes. Children, all martyrs, children, women, elderly. We have no idea what to do. They are injured everywhere. All the volunteers went down hand in hand just to help people.
Israeli officials acknowledge carrying out the airstrike on the refugee camp, describing it as a, quote, wide-scale strike targeting a Hamas commander accused of helping to orchestrate Hamas's October 7th attack inside Israel that resulted in the deaths of about 1,400 people in Israel and the capture of over 220 hostages. The attack on Jabalia came as the United Nations and aid groups issued new dire warnings about the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. James Elder of UNICEF said Gaza's becoming a graveyard for children.
The numbers are appalling. Reportedly now more than 3,450 children have been killed. Staggeringly, this number rises significantly every single day. Gaza has become a graveyard for children. It's a living hell for everyone else. And yet the threats to children go beyond bombs and mortars. I want to speak briefly now on two of those, water and trauma. The more than 1 million children of Gaza have a critical water crisis. Gaza's water production now, its capacity is at 5% of its daily output. So child deaths to dehydration, particularly infant deaths to dehydration, are a growing threat.
Earlier today, the Rafah border crossing with Gaza was opened to allow dozens of Egyptian ambulances in to evacuate injured patients. We go now to Gaza, where we're joined by Youssef Hamash, advocacy officer in Gaza for the Norwegian Refugee Council, who lives in the Gaza Strip with his wife and two children. He's from the Jabalia refugee camp, but is joining us today from Khan Yunis. Youssef, thanks so much for joining us again. You grew up in, you were born in the refugee camp. Can you talk about the significance of what took place yesterday?
So, yes, proudly, I'm born and raised in Jabalia camp as a refugee, and Jabalia camp is not a place that for us to consider. It's more than a place, and place that where the attack is the center of the Jabalia camp. It's the heart of the camp. And everyone knows that Gaza is one of the most densely populated places on Earth. Jabalia camp is the most densely populated place in Gaza. So, and for people who doesn't know how it's Jabalia camp, it's a block of concrete. Houses are next to each other. And the widest street in Jabalia camp is half a meter. And 90% of the houses are one roof, it's one floor. And it's one of the most crowded places on Earth. The attack yesterday, the massive amount of casualties, it was, first of all, the massive bombardment. And also, because it's a very populated place, and I don't think the Israelis really care about that, when they want to target someone, and I'm not sure about these accusations, where they're targeting, what's going on there, but it's really a horrific situation, and if you look to the images, what was going on, it's really horrible.
Can you respond to the Israeli military saying they bombed, they aimed for the alleyways, not the buildings, and that they were going for one of the commanders of Hamas, and that people should have left, that they warned Palestinians to leave northern Gaza and go south?
First of all, if they're pushing people to leave, where people should go? First of all, I was lucky because I have relatives in the south in Khan Yunis. But thousands of people are in the streets or Norway schools, and there is no enough place for anyone anymore in the south. And even there is no safe passage for people to move from the north toward the south. People cannot leave their houses without knowing where they are going. And this is one thing. If you live in Jabalia, it means that you can handle your situation and keep up and handling your needs in Jabalia. If you are going to a new place without somewhere to go and even doesn't know where to go, how people would keep up when they are displaced? This is completely illegal, first of all. And you cannot push more than 1 million people to move in a few days. And until now, for example, since a few days, even the roads have been cut between. They split Gaza in two parts. How people are going to go from Jabalia in the north or Gaza City towards the south? This is the first thing. And the other thing, I think the images and what the amount of casualties can answer what the Israeli forces are saying.
I wanted to play for you a clip of the IDF, Israeli Defense Force spokesperson, Lieutenant Colonel Richard Hecht, who appeared on CNN, where he was interviewed by Wolf Blitzer.
But you know that there are a lot of refugees, a lot of innocent civilians, men, women and children in that refugee camp as well, right?
This is the tragedy of war, Wolf. I mean, we, as you know, we've been saying for days, move south. Civilians are not involved with Hamas. Please move south.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get a little bit more information. You knew there were civilians there. You knew there were refugees, all sorts of refugees, but you decided to still drop a bomb on that refugee camp attempting to kill the Hamas commander. By the way, was he killed?
I can't confirm yet. There'll be more updated. Yes, we know that he was killed. About the civilians there, we're doing everything we can to minimize.
See if you can respond to the IDF Lieutenant Colonel Richard Hecht.
I just need to understand what they did to minimize the loss of casualties, the loss of civilians. What and asking people to leave is not a justification. This is not a justification to use this massive amount of bombardment targeting someone, and even then they cannot confirm it. And It's really weird how the world is looking to that and how they are trying to justify the killing of civilians. This is unacceptable, how to justify killings of that amount of civilians by saying that you ordered everyone to evacuate. First, people need even this is illegal to push. These people are forced to flee. And also, there is no place that people can go to. And even here in Khan Yunis, people who are displaced, even like me, we are facing tragedy to provide our daily need, like water and bread, and it's everything is challenging here because there is not enough space in the south to host all these hundreds of thousands of people who fled from Gaza and the north. People who decided to stay there, they don't have any other solution. They don't have any other options, and there is nothing on this planet can justify killing civilians.
You are in Khan Yunis, Youssef Hamash, where you moved. Were you living in Jabalia?
I'm born and raised in Jabalia camp. Yes, I live in Jabalia.
And talk about who lives there. Talk about the refugee camp, this largest refugee camp, how it was established.
So this all the refugees camps all across Gaza have been established after the Nakba 1948, and then it have been expanded more and more. It became small cities. It's a block of concrete. It's not like the other camps that we see on the planet, like what's seen now in Khan Yunis, for example. They had designated another camp, which is a tent camp. No, it's a small city within the city as the refugee camp. And it's very densely populated. I know every corner there. I know the people who live there are refugees. And this is generations of refugees who are living in this refugee camp, who is getting expanded day by day because the amount of people are getting more and more, and there is no solutions also for refugees. So it's became not a refugee camp, it became a small city within a city. This is how the camp is. It's different than other camps in the world.
So you moved with your family to other family in Khan Yunis. After the Israeli military told people to move south, dropped thousands of pamphlets, and said they would consider you terrorist if you didn't, they bombed Khan Yunis, is that right? They bombed places in the south where they said you should go.
Even here in Khan Yunis, it's not safe. Yesterday, 50 meters away from us, they bombed their family. 18 members were killed, and it takes us until the daylight to evacuate people who were killed, and most of them were children. There is no safe place all over Gaza. And that's also another reason why people are not leaving. It's not safe in the north. It's not safe in the middle area. It's not safe in the south also. All across Gaza Strip, the bombardment didn't stop since the first day. So this is another reason why people are not moving from the north, because it's not different. Every day there is a lot of bombardment in Rafah and Khan Yunis and Deir al-Balah in the middle area and Gaza City and the north. There is no difference wherever you are in Gaza City. You are always thinking when you are going to be the next target.
So you're there in Khan Yunis. In an interview you did with Channel 4, you said it took you 5 hours to look for 1 liter of fuel in Khan Yunis. If you can talk about why fuel is important and respond to what the Israeli military is saying, why they're not letting any fuel come in, which runs hospitals, of course, saving lives, the incubators that have premature babies in them, et cetera. What this fuel shortage looks like for you, not only you as a person, a Palestinian in Gaza, but as advocacy officer in Gaza for the Norwegian Refugee Council, where you're responsible for so many refugees.
So unfortunately, even as a humanitarian actors, we cannot do our role because there is no difference between anyone here. Everyone is under the same circumstances. Fuel is very important because there is no electricity at all. Even when we have 1 week, one time per week, we have water from the municipality because they have schedule for each area. We need the fuel to push the water from the municipality lines up to the houses. That's why everything is challenging. And it's a matter, it's a layer of complexities. If you have water, you need fuel to push it to the house. To find a way to get it, and it's almost impossible. 5 hours, and I was lucky to did it. Since 3 days, we are trying to find another liter, and I couldn't make it. I was lucky because I found someone who's a friend of mine, and his car was having some fuel. Now, unfortunately, since 3 days, we don't have fuel. Today, we have the water again that from the municipality lines, and unfortunately, we couldn't push it to the house. So we have had to fill small galleons, and we had to create a lines of us inside the house to handle each other, to carry the water to the house tanks. Everything is challenging, and day by day, everything became more impossible. And it's layers above layer of complexities and needs. We don't have electricity, we don't have fuel, we don't have water, and we are lacking everything. We don't have access for our basic needs, and unfortunately, we don't see that efforts to push to allow for fuel for other basic needs for Palestinians. Even these trucks that came in on a daily basis, the maximum amount of trucks reached 50 trucks per day. Before this war started, Gaza was having more than 500 trucks per day without that amount of need from the war. So it's really unacceptable how the world is behaving toward that. It's not a victory that they succeeded to manage to get these trucks to come. This is not a victory for anyone. This is a drop in the ocean of needs.
Yousef Hamash, they cut off communication again. We didn't even know if we'd be able to talk to you, but now the electricity, at least where you are, is back on. Can you talk about the significance of this cutting off of cell phone and electricity that also happened over the weekend, what it means for you, and also what's happening at Rafah today?
So this is the second round.
But first, start with, yes, the cutoff.
So this is the second time that, this is the second time that they isolated us from the rest of the planet. We didn't have access to phone calls, internet, or even radio stations. So literally, we didn't know what was happening in the next street. We were completely isolated inside our houses. And here to find internet, I think there is a lot of chaos around me because I need to go to a cafe where there is at least they have generator, they have some electricity, so I can have access to internet to have this interview with you. Everything is challenging, and being isolated from the rest of the world, we wasn't knowing what's happening in the north or in Gaza City or anywhere else in Gaza. We were just completely in a blackout. I don't know how it's acceptable to do this to us, and I don't think we are very good people in Kobe. We have a very good Kobe mechanism, but we cannot cope with this. We don't have communication. It's lacking us from everything. And this is very dangerous, especially for the emergency situations. You cannot call an ambulance. When they did it a few days ago, it was for 2 days, 36 hours. People who are trying to get an ambulance after an attack, or even if they have a medical situation inside the house, they have to go to the hospital, informing them and bring them back with them to the house to take someone who is, for example, if they are sick or even if they are injured from an attack.